You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, January 31st, 2019. I'm Andy Donner, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
For the blessed warning light, farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flushing at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
As has been previously announced, this week is a scheduled rerun week. You'll note I've been absent from social media and other things for, well, a couple weeks now. That is because I'm busy dealing with all sorts of things. Accordingly, Harold's early talk from 2011 about, among other things, dealing with life in a politically correct cesspool seems appropriate given circumstances. Enjoy.
Okay, first up tonight is the ongoing revolution in Egypt. I've had a number of people ask me what I think about it. Well, for one thing, I'm having a good laugh at all these liberal fools who, for some reason, are celebrating the street riots in Egypt as some kind of quote-unquote velvet revolution, or another one of their silly buzzwords. But these idiots clearly don't have the remotest understanding of Middle Eastern politics, and they don't have a clue what's going on. Hosni Mubarak's regime in Egypt is not only a staunch ally of the United States, read puppet, that's to the tune of about $1 billion a year or so. It's also, to my knowledge, only one of three Muslim nations officially to recognize Israel, the other two being Turkey and Jordan. And I doubt Turkey's going to be on board with that too much longer if the Israelis keep on seizing their ships on the high seas and slaughtering their crews like they did last year. Egypt is actually the second largest recipient of American foreign aid after Israel itself. I guess the liberal bloggers and talking heads on MSNBC think that the end result of all this rioting and burning in the streets in Cairo and Alexandria is going to be some kind of election in Egypt where some nice Barack Obama clone in a suit gets elected president and all of a sudden the Muslims are miraculously transformed into benevolent genies riding magic carpets and spreading love and flower power all through the Middle East. Oh boy, have they got another thing coming. They're going to be disappointed big time. What's going on in the streets of Cairo right now is an Egyptian election. They're just dispensing with all the American-style dog and pony show of polls and huge campaign funds and TV ads and scripted debates where real alternative candidates like Ron Paul are excluded. Now, can you say Islamic fundamentalism? Sure you can. What we're seeing in Tunisia and Egypt today is the result of 30 years of work by the Underground Muslim Brotherhood, one of the oldest of the Muslim fundamentalist organizations. Now, they learned their lesson in Algeria back in the 80s when they played by the rules, they ran in a national election, they won the election, and the sitting government just said, no, screw you, we're not handing over power to you ragheads, and arrested them all. For them, from then on, there were no more elections, a lesson that we have yet to learn in this country. The Muslim Brotherhood has done all the things that we're going to have to do. They've established a local infrastructure all throughout North Africa and Yemen, maybe in Saudi Arabia as well. In any block of crummy apartments on any street in Tunis or Cairo, everybody knows who the local Brotherhood guy is, and he's kind of a godfather that they go to whenever they really need help, not the government that's run by corrupt American and Jewish puppets like Hosni Mubarak. Oh, by the way, I was checking my online news just now, and I see that the Tunisian insurrectionary mob has just burned the largest synagogue in the capital city to the ground. Doesn't sound like a velvet revolution or a jasmine revolution or a gossamer revolution or whatever to me. Like Hamas and the Hezbollah and like the Khomeini Organization in pre-revolutionary Iran, the Muslim Brotherhood in places like North Africa and Yemen and Turkey provides medical services, food, jobs, family support, goods and services that the poor can't otherwise access. In essence, the Muslim Brotherhood is already the real government in large parts of the Middle East down on the street level. The Northwest Front is somehow, someday, going to have to assume that role for the white community here in the homeland, so that when the time comes for us to step forward, we have a base of support. Now, I got a hot flash for these Arianna Huffington types. Nothing remotely resembling your version of so-called quote-unquote democracy and freedom is going to arise out of a mass rebellion in the Middle East, ever. Take a look at those mobs. They don't want the vote, and they don't want democracy, and they don't want Obamacare and Starbucks. They can make their own coffee quite well, thank you. Those people want blood. Hosni Mubarak's blood. They want the blood of the Jews and the Americans who have propped him up for 30 years. Now this is real politics, people. The kind of politics we've forgotten in this country since 1865. Liberals have somehow developed this bizarre idea that these so-called velvet revolutions in the Third World are going to result in some kind of multicultural shining city on the hill or some kingdom of heaven with Rachel Maddow as the king and John Stewart as the queen. And they refuse to give up this idea even in the face of 50 years of being proven wrong time and again. The old-style liberals used to idealize the Soviet Union, the empire of Lenin and Stalin and Khrushchev that murdered so many millions of people that the figure is simply beyond calculation. Then later on, it was Cuba. Liberals are always looking to some kind of foreign workers' paradise or whatever, and every time it turns out to be some kind of murderous dictatorship, which is the way that the cards will eventually fall in Egypt. Politics outside the Western democracies is still a meat grinder, as it was in our own history before the white man became completely spineless and feminized. Now, you know that bad old dictator we overthrew in Iraq, Saddam Hussein? When he was a young revolutionary, he took part in an abortive revolt against whatever king or general was running Baghdad at the time. I forget. I think it was Mossadegh. Anyway, Saddam was wounded. He made it to a safe house. He dug the bullet out of his leg himself. And he rode several hundred miles across the burning desert on a donkey to safety in Jordan. Now, how many of America's presidents have done any such thing? The last one we had who was even a military veteran was George Bush Sr., and that was 20 years ago. When the Ba'ath Party revolt in Iraq, that was Saddam's group, eventually succeeded in overthrowing the government, they killed the Iraqi president of the time, and they dragged his body through Baghdad behind a jeep. Now, that's the kind of inauguration parade I'd like to see in this country. You might also check out who's doing all the rioting. Young, unemployed Arab men. Now, anytime you have large numbers of jobless young men of any race and in any country who have nothing better to do with their lives than hang around on street corners, that's a potentially revolutionary situation, and we're starting to get closer to that situation here. We have 20% real unemployment in the United States, and the majority of those unemployed are white males. Many of them aren't 99ers yet, meaning that their 99 weeks of benefits haven't run out. And beyond that, I'm sure there's still a few stop gaps that most people can apply. But you'll note that the Democrats and the state-controlled media are now talking about 10% unemployment being the new normal. Now, who will comprise the majority of those unemployed? White males. Eventually, even the dumbest whigger among them will notice the fact that we still have millions of illegal third-world aliens all around us, riding around in new SUVs and pickup trucks and with the salsa music blaring, and none of them seem to have any difficulty copping jobs and welfare and health benefits that ordinary white families can't access anymore. Now, what's going to happen then? Will white people ever come out into the streets by the millions like they have in Egypt? And demand that whatever fool is in the White House get his ass out of there now, with no dog and pony show every 4 years? Well, I don't think so, for reasons I've gone into before on this show, but hey, I've been wrong before. I've already explained why I believe it's impossible for us to take back all of the United States, but believe me, nothing would make me happier than to see a million angry white men marching down Pennsylvania Avenue with pitchforks and torches and guns. Now, last August, Glenn Beck got, what, 85,000 people out on the Ellipse? Suppose they had all just done an about-face and charged the White House fence. I don't think it's ever going to happen, but like I say, I've been wrong before. And if it does happen, I will be the first to get on this show, if I can, and admit that I was wrong. Let's hope I am wrong. And like I say, I'd love to see something like this happen in this country. Those third worlders make it look so easy. You really do wonder sometimes why it is that all those brown people that we so despise have the chops to do the things that we can't or won't do. All I can do is remind you once again that what we're seeing here in Egypt and Tunisia and maybe Jordan and a few other places now is the culmination of 30 years of long, hard, underground work on behalf of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's included prison and death and hanging and torture and you name it. Basically, these brown people that we so hate seem to be able to do what we can't do. They seem to have the moral fiber necessary to be true revolutionaries. I believe that white people do still have that kind of strength somewhere in them, but we're going to have to dig deep to find it. Now, the long-term joker in the deck in all of this is oil, of course, mainly the oil of Saudi Arabia. That's the mother lode. King Abdullah is 86 years old and in poor health, and Crown Prince Sultan, his successor, isn't much younger. And that's the bad news for the United States and the West. The West depends on those tanker shipments of oil that have been moving through the Straits of Hormuz and the Suez Canal. The so-called developed world can't keep its act together more than a week without that steady mainline of Arabian oil, even though that doesn't represent all or even most of the oil in the world. But the margins are too thin. There's no wiggle room. If the United States of America loses 10% of our oil supply, either because a revolution in Egypt closes the Suez Canal or because some harebrained Israeli attack on Iran starts a war and closes the Straits of Hormuz, then that's all she wrote for business as usual around here. Looking at those mobs in Egypt, one wonders whether the balloon really is about to go up. A massive oil shortage and gasoline at $7 a gallon, $8 a gallon might do it. Because, I mean, who can afford those prices anymore? Nobody's got any jobs in this country. Remember something else. This hullabaloo in the Middle East is only the first stirring of political reaction to a scarcity of key world resources, especially grain, which has never been in such short supply in modern times. It's no coincidence that all of the main grain-exporting countries of the world, i.e. the United States, Canada, and Russia, are white-controlled. But even white people can't control bad weather, and democracy and capitalism won't control greed and incompetence. Now, what's going to happen when there is some massive crop failure one year, and all of a sudden, nobody's getting any grain? Short term, what's going to happen when Egypt is taken over by some kind of Islamic fundamentalist regime, and they tear up the peace treaty with Israel? What will happen when the said Islamic regime in Egypt breaks the blockade of Gaza and starts supplying Hamas with some real weaponry like all those American weapons and ammunition and tanks and helicopters and artillery that the United States has been loading Mubarak's government up with for all these years? What will happen when an Israeli attack on Iran precipitates another war with Egypt? How long before America gets sucked into another stupid invasion of yet another Middle Eastern country and has to try and control another 80 million pissed off Muslims? You fools, both liberal and neocon, need to hang up this bizarre illusion you both seem to entertain that somehow or other some cataclysmic event is going to transmute Muslims into us. Ain't happening, idiots. We do indeed live in interesting times. Okay, I got an email from Alaska Mike, who made a very good point. Harold, perhaps you should clarify as to what things of the 1950s you think are unattainable. Everybody likes Buddy Holly. Do you mean the keeping of fags in the closet? It seems a lot of 50 stuff would be well suited for the homeland. True enough, in The Hill of the Ravens, I spoke of the Ministry of Culture taking white people back as far as the 1890s in dress and so forth. Again, when I talk about the BCs, as I've come to call them, the Beaver Cleavers, to cut to the chase, I mean those who believe that it will be somehow possible to revive the old ways and bring back the past to live the way that they want to live, which is an essentially middle-class and affluent all-white society with no perversion and no liberal crap, no interfering government, no filth on TV, so forth and so on. And they think it's possible to do this without eventually confronting the United States and its armed men, which, in my opinion, is where they fall down. I think it's burying our heads in the sand. It's a way of avoiding, in our own minds, the moral necessity of physical revolution. one of the many ways in which we rationalize away the requirement that we earn our new way of life by displaying physical courage and confronting and overcoming the people who seek to do us harm and keep us in chains. On this month's issue of the Northwest Observer, I discuss this in the front page editorial, and I also go so far as to let one of the primary spokesmen for the BC viewpoint, a gentleman named Farnham O'Reilly, have his own say for about the first 10 pages or so. Guys, I hate to come off like I am in some way mocking and deriding these people, because that's not what I intend, but we just have to have some clarity in our thinking here. Now, this is something else that the movement needs to work on, by the way, this idea that it's genuinely possible to have serious and sincere differences of opinion about white racial issues without it leading to a lifelong smear vendetta on the internet. But the fact is that I do believe that these people are dangerously mistaken if they think that there's some easy way out of this horrible situation we're in, one that doesn't involve risk. And I'm not talking about just financial risk. I think that the main problem that a lot of these people have is that they seriously underestimate the sheer malevolence of the regime that we live under. One of the main items on the liberal agenda has always been homogenization. The mixing of the races and religions and cultures and everything else into a big bubbling cauldron they call a melting pot, and then coming up with a brown fluid that looks like something you'd find in a porta potty. As insane as that vision is, that is the vision of the people who rule us. Everybody has to be like them, and the United States government has used lethal force time and again whenever anyone has tried to simply opt out of the system voluntarily. Ruby Ridge, Waco, the Texas Mormons, the Republic of Texas group a few years back, the Montana Freemen. Do these names ring any bells? Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that we've done it. We've taken over some small rural county in Idaho or Montana. We've voted ourselves into office. We've got a nice little town of about 10,000 people. We've got our mayor and our city council and our own sheriff and fire department. Everybody lives in split-level suburban ranch houses or on little 5-acre plots of land with their own gardens. And all the kids walk to the little red schoolhouse every morning. And every Saturday there's steaks and burgers on the backyard barbecue and softball in the sand lots. And every Sunday everybody dresses up and goes to a nice little whitewashed Protestant church and then goes out to the Golden Corral buffet. We've got the whole nine yards, and it's all white. We've done it. But you see, there's one little thing that we forgot when we were building our Beaver Cleaverville, the revolution. We didn't want to do that. We thought we'd take a pass on that because revolutions are bloody and dangerous and nasty and generally not nice. The big bad policeman might hurt us. And so Beaver Cleaverville, which we're so proud of, is still part of the United States. The laws passed by those 535 yay-saying leeches in Congress still apply in Beaver Cleaverville. We are still part of the FBI's jurisdiction, and the residents of Beaver Cleaverville still have to pay taxes to that Moloch in D.C., and come 2014, all of us are going to still be required to shell out $15,000 a year for Obamacare, something like that, so that Juan Mendez can keep on getting himself and his mamacita and his 12 bambinos treated for free in the emergency room down in Los Angeles. What are we going to do in Beaver Cleaverville when the first truckload of Mexicans rolls into town looking to work in people's yards for $3 an hour, and maybe do a little carpentry for $5 an hour that will save the local construction company thousands of dollars in wages and health insurance? Of course, Beaver Cleaverville will be a proper capitalist society, and so no one will really be able to blame the construction company for saving that money. But what are we going to do? Are we going to have the sheriff run them out of town? Can't do that. Federal civil rights violations. We're part of the United States, remember? Now, what are we going to do when the first pair of bugger boys shows up holding hands and wants to buy a house right smack dab in the middle of Beaver Cleaverville? Burn them out? We can't do that. Federal civil rights violation. Beaver Cleaverville is still part of the United States, and we're going to have carloads of FBI men in suits rolling into Beaver Cleaverville and arresting people. And legally, our white sheriff won't be able to do squat. Remember what happened in Mississippi in the 1960s? The FBI basically became Lyndon Johnson's private goon squad, dragging away anybody they wanted to. The problem with trying to build Beaver Cleaverville without the blood and fire and death of a revolution that removes the United States from power is that it leaves us at the mercy of America, and America will not allow Beaver Cleaverville to exist, because the liberals and the Jews who run the government and the media and the universities and the banks and who command the men with the guns that we refuse to confront have decided that we all have to be like them. We could spend 20 years putting our hearts and souls into building Beaver Cleaverville, Idaho, and we would lose it all in a day when some bureaucrat in Washington or some Jew dyke media bitch like Rachel Maddow noticed us and put their foot down. Sorry, guys, there's no way out. We are going to have to man up and confront the United States and its armed men someday. Now, getting back to your question, Mike. After the revolution, if we reach a racial consensus as to what kind of life we want for ourselves and our children, and it contains a healthy dash of the 1950s, I'm good with that. There was a lot that was good about that time, and I've never denied that, although personally I think women's fashions suck. 1940s and 50s styles make women look dowdy, I think, but that's just me. Our new Northwest nation probably will have a generous dollop of the Beaver and the Brady Bunch, just like it'll have a little National Socialism and a little libertarianism and a lot of guns. But we have to get that revolution thing taken care of first. Okay, first music break. I had somebody ask me recently when I was going to play some more Scandinavian black metal rock. This is the Finnish group Korpiklaani.
Thank you.
Okay, got an audio file this week from Gretchen the Librarian in New England, wherein she finally says nigger. Yay!
Good evening, comrades. Well, Harold has challenged me to use the word nigger on the show. And I'm thinking to myself, that's a way to get into really big trouble. And why would I want to do that? Of course, I've already been on the show 6 times, so I guess I'm already pretty much in trouble. So, the interesting thing is, how did I first learn that word? I really am not quite sure, although I think it was my dear grandmother on my mother's side who used to babysit me when I was very, very young. And she used to like to say that little nursery rhyme that eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch the nigger by the toe, if he hollers, let him go. And she said that, I think, a few times, but I also think sometimes she would say tiger. I know she would sometimes say tiger, and I'm not really sure if she always said tiger, but I don't think she always said tiger. I think what happened was, now my mother has told me this, she said, yeah, she said that nursery rhyme all the time. But my mother said, I talked to her and I told her that that word was, even in my day, even when I was young, it was quite out of style and I better start saying the word tiger. So I learned it both ways. And I don't know, I was the kind of kid that didn't repeat very much. But the interesting thing is, how did I know what she meant by that? Because sometimes today, I mean, I've heard of kids today who would not understand that word and they wouldn't even know what it was. I don't know how I knew what it was. I mean, I don't remember asking what it was. I remember picturing that sort of minstrel show looking like almost a cartoon character when she would say that. I kind of knew what it meant, but I don't know how I knew. So there was that, but I don't remember too much about other people saying it. Well, at any rate, other family members may have said that, but I don't want to go into who they were. I mean, my dear grandmother, she's now passed on, so I guess I can talk about her a bit, but other people I don't want to say. You know, the origin of it really comes from Latin, apparently. I remember studying Latin at the private school that I attended, and there was a word called negarum, I think, which meant obscure, it meant dark. And, of course, there's the Niger River, and there's Niger and Nigeria on the map, and apparently they haven't changed the names of those countries, although it surprises me they haven't changed the name. If the word Negro is offensive, then the word Niger must be really bad, and they should probably change the name of those countries. But they haven't changed it. And then I was doing some more research on Google, and there is some claim made that the word was Egyptian, or maybe even Sub-Saharan. There was a word NGR, but I seem to find it on sites that are probably Black National sites, so I'm not really sure of that information completely, but it is possibly Egyptian. And not to say that the Egyptians were Black, I don't know that they necessarily were, I don't think so. I don't think they're really Black, they were probably dark. The way that my now deceased uncle used to deal with it is he used to say, or at least towards the end of his life, he would claim that the word should only be used in reference to Blacks who are, say, gangbangers or drug addicts. And I see what he was saying. He was in a rather delicate situation towards the end of his life because his wife, my aunt through marriage, she had people in her family. She had a lot of nieces and nephews, and some of her nieces had become involved in mixed marriages, and or one of them did at any rate, and had a mixed son. And I don't know if there was any more than one child, but at any rate, he was in a somewhat delicate situation. So he had to make his views, I suppose, more nuanced. And I can understand what he's saying. From a biological standpoint, though, I mean, I'm thinking, well, a gangbanger may have a cousin who has a PhD, or they may have a relative who becomes a minister and is therefore more respectable than they are. But, you know, genetically, they're both, you could say they're both Nigerians there. So, I mean, I see what he's saying. He had a point in a way, but it's kind of a pointless point. So that was how I felt about that. And, well, my uncle is now passed on. And so, you know, I think it was a rationalization that he made towards the end of his life. That's really about all that I have to say about that. I mean, I understand Harold's point. He doesn't want any thought police. He wants people to be able to speak freely. And I also don't want to be a sensationalist. And because our problems are primarily our fault, I really don't want to denigrate others and say demeaning things about other people and what they are. I don't, you know, whether I personally like them or not is, you know, beside the point. I'm starting to, I don't want to start rambling here, but because our problems are mainly our fault, I think that transferring blame or bad words to other people, to me, I'm uncomfortable with that because I feel that self-blame, I mean, I guess I have a rather puritanical desire for self-blame, but I think it's more effective than saying someone else is no good. So I do believe in responsibility. I was in school and I had a Nigerian instructor who was talking about different theories in the white community, largely theories of suicide, how the white community could commit racial suicide. And there are different methodologies, and there was one methodology called white responsibility, where white people take responsibility for all the harm that they brought to other communities, whether it be Native Americans or Nigerians, or even people that maybe have really had no connection or no particular connection with whites, but still they're brown skinned and therefore deserve all kinds of kudos. And they deserve to get all the money from whites because we really shouldn't exist. I was thinking to myself, well, I do believe in white responsibility, and I would say our primary responsibility is to the 14 words. So, yes, I'm for white responsibility myself, and she mentioned some other philosophies that I don't quite remember now because white responsibility was the one that stuck in my mind. I feel like, yeah, we should take responsibility for primarily solving our problems for our survival as a race and into the future. So those are my thoughts this evening. Thank you for listening, comrades.
Right, let's go over this again. What we're talking about here is thought control. The liberals try to prohibit the use of certain words so that we won't be able to formulate certain thoughts. The regime makes public usage of such words punishable economically and in some cases legally. The objective is to make white people so afraid that they might actually blurt out the words nigger and faggot in public and be punished through the loss of their job and the loss of status and material wealth, that they censor their own thoughts and force themselves not even to think these words. Well, you might ask, what's wrong with using nice, polite terminology about people we don't like? Why shouldn't we be respectful of other people, even if we disagree with them? Let me tell you the two things wrong with that sentence. The words people and disagree. To use the term people for niggers and beaners and faggots and liberals implies equality, and equality is the basis upon which this whole mess is founded. Equality is a false idea. It's wrong. It's not true. We are not in any way, shape, or form equal to niggers, beaners, Jews, faggots, or liberals. We are racially conscious white revolutionaries, and that means that we are better than they are, and they are inferior to us. The fact that we are superior to them is what gives us the moral right to rule and not them. And that fact needs to be reflected in the language that we use. The second problem is that word disagree. This is not a disagreement or a polite conversation over tea and crumpets in the vicar's rose garden. What these people do to us and to our country and our civilization is a matter of life and death. They're not people. They are our enemies. Their whole reason for existence is to take what we have and to do harm to us and to our families. We shouldn't respect them, no. We should be stomping on them like cockroaches, smashing their faces with baseball bats, dousing them with gasoline and setting them on fire, whatever we have to do in order to make them stop. Someday, white males will find within ourselves the courage to deal with these enemies of ours as they should be dealt with. Courtesy and mild, polite disagreement long ago ceased to have anything to do with the racial and political situation in this country. Ask Channon Christian and Chris Newsom from Knoxville, Tennessee, if this crisis is a matter of polite disagreement. Oh, I'm sorry, you can't ask them anything. They were both kidnapped, raped, and murdered by niggers. Not by black men. Not by African Americans. Not by urban youths. Chris Newsom and Channon Christian were kidnapped, raped, sodomized, and murdered by the form of nappy-headed, shit-skinned animal life known as niggers. Look, Gretchen, please don't think I'm scolding you or berating you in public here. I hate it when people think that, because that is never my intention. But guys, before we can begin the process of resisting in our real lives, before we can even make the basic commitment of upping stakes and physically coming here to our homeland, we have to get our minds right. In order to think truth, we must literally have the words, the language in which to formulate it. Niggers are our truth. Therefore, nigger is what we must say. There's something else I need to say here, because the issue comes up in many forms almost every week in some way or other in the responses and the comments I get regarding this show. I need for all of you to understand something. I need for you to understand, first of all, that the Northwest Front is a revolutionary movement and that we are revolutionaries. Okay, I've said that often enough before, but there's something else I need for all of you to internalize here. Dead serious. And that is that revolutionaries, by definition, are not nice people. We can't be, because the people trying to do us harm aren't nice. If we're going to win, and we must win, failure means racial extinction, and that's not an option. If we're going to win, we must be stronger, tougher. Our hearts must be harder, and we must be prepared to go farther than they will. I've said all of this in my four Northwest Independence novels, in many places and in many ways. Now, no doubt when some of you first read those passages, you found them very exciting and entertaining. Read them again. And this time, bear in mind that I'm not joking. I know last week was supposed to be our folk ballad showcase, but I came across this one and I just like the banjo work. This is Susan and Dana Robinson.
Before the dawn, gone to a brighter home, he burned the kiln till past sundown, where grief cannot come. Gone but not forgotten, he slaved for his master half his span, gone to a brighter home, the other half, a freed man, where grief cannot come. Gone but not forgotten. Oberlin village in Bramble Row, gone to a brighter home, is tended by four black crows, where grief cannot come. Gone but not forgotten. In a sunken grave, John Dunstan lies, gone to a brighter home, a city traffic rumbles by where grief cannot come. Gone but not forgotten, soft shade of oak and maple tall, gone to a brighter home, overshadowed by a towering wall where grief cannot come. Gone but not forgotten,
yeah, I know, the actual lyrics of that song could be construed a bit ambiguously, but like I said, I just like the banjo work. Now, this leads into a topic I've been meaning to discuss for a while. I've lost the original email, but the question came from Aaron in Arizona, and it went something like, "Dear HAC, how do you stand day-to-day living in this cesspool? How can you stand to turn on the TV and see all the crap on the internet without going insane? The race mixing, the Jew and liberal lies, the sheer magnitude of the bullshit we all live with. I'm not going to be one of those white men who flips out with a gun in a shopping mall, but I'd really like to know how you stand it without going completely batshit," or words to that effect. Well, for one thing, Aaron, I don't have a TV. Last time I had cable, which was some years ago, I ended up paying something like $75 a month for nothing but drivel, and it's just not worth it. Besides, I'm too busy now to bother with TV, but I know what you mean, Aaron. Yeah, I know movement comrades who become so obsessed with what's going on around them and their inability to make other people see what's going on around them, the inability to make other people listen, that they go a bit nuts. And yes, I admit it. And I've approached that level myself a few times in the past, but I've always had a few things going for me. One is the fact that I know that I am doing everything I possibly can to correct the situation. I know that I have a part in the solution to all this. I think if it hadn't been for my dedication to National Socialism at first, and then later on the Northwest Migration, I probably would be some kind of raving nut right now. It's happened to a lot of people I know. There is a strain of being a one-eyed man in the country of the blind, so to speak, that is just almost impossible to bear sometimes. Do I see race-mixed couples and white girls with mulatto babies around here? Yes, I do, because we have a lot of military in this area. And unfortunately, military means niggers and assorted scum. I see white men with their little sunshine girls that they picked up, you know, Filipino and Korean bar girls and whores and that sort of stuff. I see them on the streets and in the stores and so forth. And so how do I deal with it? You have to learn to kind of look through a lot of the crap. Just train your mind so it doesn't register when you see it. And one of the ways you can do that is, like I said, convince yourself that you're playing a role as a spy behind enemy lines, as if you're living in the middle of a communist society or something, which in a way, of course, you are. And also the moral knowledge, as I mentioned, that you are actually part of the solution. You have a racial duty to your people. That racial duty involves you remaining functional in society, and it involves you keeping on your toes, keeping your cool, and doing what you can to bring this beast down. And we can bring it down. What each of us is doing here is nothing but a pinprick. But 1,000 pinpricks put together can bleed the beast to death. If you are going to do your bit, you're going to be like a soldier in the army. You're going to be one cog in the wheel, one member of the team. But you've got to pull your weight. You can't pull your weight in this revolutionary struggle if you flip out every time you see a race-mixed couple, or if you go off and rant and rave at the Chinese idiot in your laundry or whenever, or if you go berserk and attack your boss with a Sharpie or something like that in your workplace. You don't do anybody any good, yourself or the racial struggle or your friends or your whole race. You don't do those people any good if you become unable to function. You have to be able to get a job, hold a job, pay your bills, and function in this madhouse. And that's not easy. I know it's not easy. I know it can drive you around the twist. I've come close a couple of times myself, like I've said, but you just have to learn to accept and to live with the fact that in our lifetime, things will probably never be perfect. That's one way I deal with the flow of crap from Hollywood. You have to learn to discern and accept the good in a lot of what you see coming down the pike in this society. And there is some of it, because Hollywood and the government and the banking system and Rush Limbaugh and all these people are never going to be completely perfect by our standards. Everything that comes out of this system, everything that comes out of this system's maw or gut, everything that gets puked all over us by the system is always going to be, at least to some degree, tainted with Jewish values and idiotic liberalism and race mixing and every other thing, because that's what the system does. It is a machine for producing toxic waste, which it then dumps all over our heads. Now, you have to accept this for a fact. You have to accept that this is the way things are, and pledge to yourself that you are going to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. And that means inuring yourself, toughening yourself to accepting this massive flow of toxic waste over your head every day, and doing just a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit every day to bring it to an end. Anyway, this is hard to explain, but like I say, you just have to learn to tune out all of the static, to compartmentalize, and to focus on your own racial mission. Because if you don't, if you let yourself slip, if you let yourself fall into alcoholism or despair or depression or plain nutty conspiracy theories, if you become one of these people that says, oh, it's the Jews, there's Jews everywhere, there's Jews under my bed, blah, 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 something like that, you're not functioning and you're not carrying out your mission. Think of yourself as a soldier with a job to do. Like an old drill sergeant I once had said, shut up and soldier, soldier. Does that make any sense? Anyway, that's about the best I can do. And now here's a little German march music for you more traditional types out there. This is Preußen's Gloria, Prussia's Glory. Thank you. The white race is on the verge of physical extinction, of literally disappearing from the face of the earth. We'll officially become a minority in North America by the year 2050 and in Europe by about 2100. In actual fact, the racial and demographic point of no return is a lot closer than that, by which I mean the point where there will no longer be enough white females of childbearing age to replenish our numbers. Now, this situation has been deliberately created not by one single vast conspiracy, but by a series of movements or tendencies over the past 200 years, variously called secular humanism, liberal democracy, civil rights, multiculturalism, feminism, etc. Now, it's true that many of these movements or tendencies are largely Jewish in origin, but they're invariably assisted and abetted by morally denatured white people who genuinely believe that what they're doing is right and that their own people and civilization must perish in order to fulfill some sort of weird historic karma. The problem is not the Jews. They were put here on Earth by a cosmic power or force different from the one that placed us here, for the express purpose of acting as a plague bacillus among us and eventually destroying us. Our worst enemy is the morally denatured white people who help and worship the Jew, followed by the white man who knows the truth and who does nothing. Now, this is the greatest crisis in human history. Nothing, let me repeat that, nothing is more important than this struggle. Everything, let me repeat that, everything in our lives must be subordinated to preventing the extinction of our species. The crisis of our racial existence cannot be solved through the generation or the distribution of words. The crisis can only be defeated through physical acts. It is impossible to solve the crisis of our impending racial extinction through acts that the enemy will approve of, that the enemy will allow, or which don't cause the enemy inconvenience or anger them. In other words, there can be no working within the system. The system is designed to keep us in servitude, and it can't be turned against its owners and operators because it's based on massive amounts of money which we do not have and cannot get. It's impossible to solve the crisis of our impending racial extinction without causing ourselves extreme personal inconvenience and without incurring personal risk, possibly involving physical pain, privation, imprisonment, and death. It's impossible to solve the crisis of our impending racial extinction without the eventual use of organized military armed force to kill our enemies and otherwise remove them by force from the positions of state power that they hold. Now let me clarify again that I am not advocating or inciting any such action at this time because we would lose and we cannot afford to lose. We must not lose, because if we lose now, then we lose everything. But we have to stop being afraid to think in those terms. There's no one among us with more than two brain cells to rub together who seriously believes that there can be any peaceful or legal solution to this crisis. The only viable strategy that holds out any serious hope for the survival of our race lies in selecting some area of the earth and physically seizing it from the enemy, there to establish a sovereign nation for Aryans only. For reasons that are too lengthy to go into here, the only viable area where we might attempt this with any chance of success is the Pacific Northwest. There's no other possible strategy for our racial survival, nor will there be one in the future. Every year, the situation gets worse, and the imperative for a country of our own becomes more clear-cut and inescapable. There will be no armed resistance to the encroaching genocide now or at any time in the foreseeable future, because racially conscious white males simply do not feel strongly enough about the crisis to place their own lives at risk in order to resolve it. Physical courage was once the most common of all white male virtues, and it's now become almost unknown among the males of our race, except in a few very narrow contexts like policemen and firefighters, etc., where politically correct society finds it necessary to allow white males to display personal valor in order to preserve and maintain the existing order. Personal bravery displayed in physical combat with weapons against an enemy was for thousands of years the hallmark of white men. This ancient and instinctive tradition has been temporarily subsumed in the past several generations by materialism, personal self-indulgence, fear of social disapproval, economic sanctions, and the institution of a largely feminized power structure by an increasingly matriarchal and homosexual society. The central cause of all our problems is the weak, materialistic, self-centered, cowardly, and slothful character of the overwhelming majority of white males, which has led to the situation that I've described up to now. Until this issue is addressed, and until we can transform the white man's thinking and the white man's character, there is no hope of revolt and no hope of our racial survival. I believe that up until the 11th hour, the 59th minute, and the 59th second, it's still possible for us to win if we can somehow find a way to change the white man's thinking and help him recover his ancient courage. Look, we're Aryans, and that means that despite it all, we are better men than they are, if we choose to be. All revolutions begin with an idea. Our idea is a homeland, a sanctuary for the white race worldwide. The Northwest Imperative has one outstanding feature. It's doable. It's doable now. We don't have to wait for some far-off time in the future when the balloon goes up. Now, this means that we can actually begin something in time to beat that 2020 deadline when we cross the demographic point of no return, and that's essential. We are racing against the biological clock and the roaring mud flow across our open borders. The Northwest Imperative is both legal and safe, and that removes 90% of the excuses that white males come up with for doing nothing. There is, in fact, nothing the enemy can do to stop us. The only other alternative to the Northwest migration is to continue generating words in various ways until we grow old and die. The Northwest migration is a completely new departure for the movement because it is not based on the generation of words, but it's predicated on an act. The relocation of a racially conscious white person into a specific country with the intention of making it a home and a haven for our people. Northwest migration is not something you say. It's something you do. Now, yes, I know. I have said all of this stuff before in many different ways. And you know something? I'm going to keep on saying it over and over and over again as long as it takes until I finally get through to you people. Because this is the truth that is going to set us free.
Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front, P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington 98310. You can visit the party on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Hail victory.
Following their footsteps, uprising of the moon, of the rising.